All right, wonderful. You know, many of you might not know who Shibley is, and I think it's worth just, and we haven't done formal introductions, but he's a wonderful example of a scholar and a thinker and a philosopher who also works in the realm of action. So I know him actually as a scholar of Islamic law, but he's also been a keen observer of Middle Eastern politics, contemporary politics, and then in the last few years, actually a participant in those, a one-time presidential candidate in Lebanon. And so it's wonderful to be able to, and an honor really, to be able to comment on his work, his academic work here, which is in the philosophical vein. And Shibley is actually, in addition to the paper which is listed in the title, he has another paper, and I understand that they're related as part of a book project. And I think I'm going to start by with that first paper, which I'm not sure everyone has seen, because I think it frames and to some degree challenges the problems raised in his second paper. In doing so, I'm going to both describe his position, but then interject my own comments throughout and randomly. So one very interesting point Shibley makes in the first paper, in thinking about the so-called Arab Spring, he prefers not to use that term. He prefers to talk about Middle Eastern nonviolent revolutions. And this is obviously correct. I mean, we talk about the Arab Spring, but of course, not everyone in the region is Arab, and the political protests, actually in some sense, in the most recent round, started in Iran, a non-Arab country. We should be also thinking about Kurds and Israelis and others who are taking to the streets as part of this wave. And so I think that's absolutely right and useful corrective. In thinking about the problems of the Arab Spring or the Middle Eastern nonviolent revolutions, Shibley's very focused on the nonviolent, the word nonviolent in that formulation. What does it mean to be nonviolent? How does it work? How does it operate? And he returns to first principles of political theory. And starts with Kant and the so-called perpetual peace argument, the idea that basically if all nations were democratic and have resolved their internal problems of violence, internal problems by having a government which channels political conflict from the streets into political institutions, once you've made that domestic move, then you would have international peace. And this is, you know, in political science, the democratic peace literature, the well-known regularity that democracies don't go to war with each other. You know, if you think about the implications of that, we should promote democratic revolutions everywhere. On the other hand, Shibley notes, there is another line of thinking that he associates with Robert Cover, which recognizes that law, in all its manifestations, always has at the background violence. At the end of the day, law works because of state coercion, at least in Cover's view. I disagree, but that's a separate point. Therefore, violence is inherent in the construction of democratic constitutional orders. And pushing that, you know, if you really have a view of nonviolence, you might say, well, then we shouldn't promote democratic revolutions everywhere. Now, the actual regime we live under with regard to democratic revolution is governed by international law. And that's the set of institutions that I call charter liberalism, the UN charter, and the sort of quasi-liberal regime it sets up. Just as in a liberal society, every individual can do what they want as long as they don't harm their neighbor, so our idea about international order is that every country can be self-determining as to how it wants to live, as long as it doesn't engage in warfare or harm neighbors. And this, of course, is at odds with the democratic peace idea, the Kantian idea pushed to its extreme, because it says you can be a dictatorship, you can be a democracy, you can be a dictatorship, and there's no general right to interfere with that state of affairs. And so that's the actual regime of international law. Nevertheless, I think as time has gone on, we've seen more and more international intervention into domestic affairs, and the International Criminal Court, which has appeared in the narrative of the recent revolutions in the Middle East in a couple of places, with Gaddafi, strangely not with Assad yet, but the International Criminal Court is obviously an international attempt to bound what you can do domestically, and so withers away at that charter liberalism. All right, so this is the paradox that he starts with, that there's you need in some sense, you know, if you're trying to get to a nonviolence, it's very difficult to do that in and especially, of course, in a situation where you're living in a particular kind of constitutional dictatorship, such as most of the citizens of this region have been living under. All right, so far so good. Now, I guess that this leads us, I think, actually, to a problem that is posed at the outset of the second paper, and that is the problem of secession, right? If you really believe in freedom to determine your own affairs, right, then we ought, one might think, to allow individual units within a free democratic nation to leave whenever they want. And this is a familiar issue, both in domestic constitutional theory, but also, of course, in international law, in thinking about the right of self-determination. The right of self-determination in international law doesn't recognize the right to secede for all peoples, but does recognize a kind of right of right of self-government over core issues to particular communities. Shibley cautions against secession at this moment in the Arab world. He wants the countries to stay together. We all recognize that these countries are artificial creations somewhat, but he thinks it's very important that they stay together. And this is where I wanted to pose a question to him. That is, to some degree, what you are saying, returning to this kind of theme about the role of violence, what you are saying, Shibley, is that that a group that wants to secede should be coerced in some sense by the majority to stay inside. And so this, in some sense, notwithstanding your celebration of the nonviolent modality of Tahrir Square and the nonviolent transformation which the revolution offers to reduce the role of coercion in state power, at the same time, for a particular group that is not allowed to secede, you know, they were being coerced in some sense, ultimately violently. My own view is that the ability, the practical ability of any particular secessionist project is in fact dependent on the level of coercion in the international sphere. So there is a reason to offer a simple example why the number of states in the world has quadrupled since World War II. Well, that's because by and large the international sphere is much more benevolent. We no longer allow big states to just conquer small states. It's because of charter liberalism, in a way, that we have allowed many, many states to flourish, that we've allowed various small state projects like Kosovo or East Timor to go forward. That's been actually supported in some sense by a reduction of violence. And that reduction in violence has not come through the Kantian vision, but rather through the vision of the UN Charter. So I guess the question I suppose I would pose to you is, what's the role of this, you're thinking about nonviolence, and is it consistent with your insistence on no secession? Okay, so that's the first point I wanted to make. Let's see, the second is that you contrast, in a way, and you have a nice narrative, really, of the history of the Arab constitutional regimes that are now disappearing, the role, the very core role of violence in the initial coups which bring about the pseudo-constitutional order, if I can use the term, the brutality that follows it, and in the most extreme case, Somalia, which you identified, the aftermath being a total failed state. And I think you warned that this is kind of a caution, in a way, of what would happen if we were to allow secession, because the various regions of Somalia have, in fact, de facto seceded. And that may be right. It may be that we get particular political goods by forcing small groups to remain together. But I think that does require a certain amount of coercion to do. So that's, again, the same paradox. Let's see. Finally, I guess you have this kind of a story at the end where you have the authoritarian constitution with its characteristic features of a weak parliament, a strong executive, rights that don't matter very much. I think this is a really nice point, and I thought mapped nicely onto Nathan's earlier work on the role of authoritarian constitutions, their structure, and why they have the features they do. I take it your argument is that regardless of the particular kind of details, whether it's a monarchy or a republic, that the unraveling of these constitutional orders is in fact very dangerous and tends to be associated with cycles of repression, cycles of violence, even in cases as we see in Syria this week or this month, where the constitutional reform is an effort by the failed or falling dictator to is sort of grasping at a last straw. But you argue that that is doomed to fail, and at the end we will end up with a revolution in one way or the other. Returning to the themes of the last hour, I think you raise the possibility that constitutional politics ought to be different than normal politics, at least in this region. What we are offered at this moment is a ability to transform politics from a kind of a legacy of violence towards a larger vision, I suppose, for what the society is, should become, toward a vision of real deliberation. And I think this is what's at the core of your idea of having a constitutional assembly that would be elected and that would be able to preserve, in some sense, that revolutionary moment of nonviolence. In the last hour, we were talking about that a little bit. Should constitutional politics really be different? It's nice if they can be sustained. But on the other hand, at some point, at the end of the day, you've got to turn over to the ordinary political functioning. Ultimately, the Constitution is going to require that in order to succeed and to be preserved. I suppose you might take issue then with my statement that I think constitutional politics generally should be more like ordinary politics, that we should recognize that it's not such a special sphere. I'll stop there and let you respond.
Thank you very much for this extremely thoughtful set of remarks, Tom. Again, I'm terribly sorry not to be with you. I was so much looking forward to seeing old friends and getting to know people I've wanted to know for a long time. It was a bit unfair for me to send the two papers together, partly because it added to your load of reading, but also because both are very incomplete. But we're thinking in media res, and it's extremely difficult to chart any way ahead without a proper understanding of what the main traits of an immense historic movement that I think started earlier than last year, but the stage 2011 might well be a year in history very similar to 1989 and or 1776, both for constitutionalism and for the shape of international relations, the Middle East being such an important region that has been wrecked with so much violence over the past 100 years. Now, the papers come together, as you can see, from a project which is still very much at the beginning. I was struck by the amount of conscious acknowledgement by millions of people in Syria, in Yemen, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and in Bahrain. But also elsewhere. There is not a single country in the Middle East that hasn't seen an element of popular street movement. The most remarkable are those five countries. And of course, we know that this is the beginning of a story which might turn extremely sour, but which might also open up possibilities that hopefully will be positive for the peoples of the region. So this dimension of nonviolence is essential for me, not only because of a personal commitment to it over the years, but because of its importance with regard to the constitutions to come. So the first argument that I tried to put forward is that there is no point in thinking constitutionalism, that is, a new social contract that is based on general principles that are recognized with nuances everywhere in the democratic world. There's no point in thinking constitutionalism without understanding the settings of the revolution that would lead to it. So talking about constitutionalism today, for instance, in Syria is pointless because the very condition that the revolution has set is a departure of the old regime. And we can see that across the region, where the old regime is not going, is not being removed, and when I say removed, that is removed at the head, we are unable to develop the constitutionalism that is serious because the main problem has remained, and that is elements of authoritarianism that negate in themselves the reason why the revolution is there. So the answer is simple in the case of Assad, for instance, or even in Yemen or in Tunisia or in Egypt. There's no point about talking about constitutionalism. It's all very nice to prepare things, but one operates a little bit in the air because the main center of the rot has not been removed. And the way he is removed, and it's always he, is obviously related to whether he's being removed forcefully, as in Libya's Qaddafi, or in ways that are more characteristically nonviolent, as in everywhere else in the system. And I include Syria, even though, of course, the militarization of the revolution in Syria has happened. We're still working very hard, and when I say we, it is people who would like to see that revolution succeed without having a massive foreign intervention and without having groups like the Syrian, what it's called, Free Syrian Army take over the street, not only because of the bloodletting that develops, but because it also creates the settings for yet another Egypt-like scenario where the revolution is being hijacked by people who take advantage of the street to take power when they have a chance. So nonviolence is important as a condition for a different time of politics. And I still think that the massive nonviolence movement that you've seen in Egypt will bear fruit with regard to getting the army out of the way. I know that we're going to discuss this afternoon the Islamic dimension, so I didn't stress it too much, although it's very much another peculiarity of the Middle East revolution, that is this other legal tradition where the debate of democracy is old, but also is constantly renewed by fresh thinking and developments on the ground. Now, on the issue of secession, you're absolutely right, Tom. The reason why I'm against secession is not on a matter of principle, curiously. Since those countries are arbitrary, and most countries are arbitrary, even the border between Canada and the United States is arbitrary and is a function of actually a sectarian Catholic Protestant divide that took the shape of that border together with other obvious historical dimensions. But so the Middle East is artificial. The problem, and it's a problem that we've seen in Africa as well, is that you start messing with the borders, then a lot of problems are bound to arise. And what we saw in the Sudan this year is just another example of the logic of secession, however brutal the regime is in the north, that is, and my contention is not that secession is bad or good. My contention is it's much better to remove the dictator who usually is the reason for these secessionist movements to take up arms in order to free themselves from his rule. So rather than seeing a new regime in the south in Sudan, I thought, and I've always been supportive of a radical change in Khartoum itself. The northerners have no less of a untenable situation because of the dictatorship of Bashir than the southerners. Of course, you know, there are differences, but, and we're not talking past history. We're talking about what is at risk in Yemen. In Yemen today, because I think the intervention of the UN in the shape of Jamal bin Omar's solution for the Yemen was not good. And I'm worried about Kofi Annan coming in and saying again, like he did with Saddam Hussein 5 years ago, oh, Assad is a guy I can do business with. If those people then come in with a principle that the guy in power has to be held accountable, and the first thing that he must do is to leave, then we're going to have our revolutions botched time and again. And we're going to see the specter of secession take the revolution into a direction which we could understand historically, but which I don't think is the one that is preferable, nor do I think is it necessary. It is not a law that southern Yemen is going to see from northern Yemen. There are going to be a lot of factors coming in. The most important one is to stop this masquerade of that election where there's only one candidate who's running for the presidency. So, you know, there's a lot at stake there, and secession is only one part. Now, when we talk about constitutionalism, again, you know, I've worked a lot with the Iraqi opposition, as many of you know, and we've written and worked about a lot about constitutions, no less. I've been part of no less than three major conferences between 1991 and 2003 that are trying to think constitutions ahead, and I think they're useful. But I think constitutionalism becomes serious only when the dictatorship has gone. Until then, you know, it's a bit talking in very general principles, which we can see in the paper. So the paper is a little bit uncertain insofar as it's trying to draw themes in the belief that one can talk seriously about constitutionalism when the dictatorship has been already removed. Now, the problem is that it's not as simple as that. And I share the interest and intelligence of Nathan's paper and other work in the first session that constitutions are not simply an empty decorum. In the same way as I think Lisa Wedeen showed that having pictures of these characters all over the public space is not simply a cult of the personality. Constitutions are used, are very important for the dictators. They have the means, whether it is what Mila said, just sending a little note after an article in the Bill of Rights part of the Constitution saying, yes, this is a principle, but then it will have to be clarified by law. Well, as soon as you do that, of course, law trumps the Constitution and the principle becomes pointless. So that's the problem I think that we have with constitutions. There is the political dimension, which is how do you get to power, who gets to power and how. And then immediately the question of transition, which is both obviously political and constitutional. Egypt is a case in point where once Mubarak was out, we still don't know what the text is that regulates, that rules the country. As you know, we had the SCAF itself saying, well, I'm appointing a committee to revise the constitution, for those parts of it that prevent free and fair elections. And Tariq Bijri, I thought, did an excellent work, minus a few political mistakes in producing it. There is a referendum, there was a referendum, and normally that text, that is the amended constitution, should be the rule in Egypt. And then SCAF came out just a few weeks after this. This committee had finished his work and published it to say, no, we're coming out with a constitutional declaration where they chose 50 articles out of the constitution, pretty meaningless. Then 10 articles where they essentially said, we're in power, we do whatever we want. So the problem with this is that there is a political tug of war, which is inevitable. But I think that the usefulness of our meeting is one where we try to identify those elements in the process that are threatening the principles of the revolution. I don't think anyone disagrees with basic dimension of the revolution being one of human rights, including dignity, including frustration because of corruption leading to economic disparity, let alone participation in power and the various freedoms and practices of torture. I think that's the common dimension of the constitution of the revolution that has shook the region in the last year. The question is, how do you take these basic principles that are shared by everyone and make them, institutionalize them in a way that works? And here there are a number of routes, and I've presented in my paper a little bit the problem of elections, how elections immediately divide the revolution, and how it is possible to keep a modicum of unity for the revolution, because inevitably there's going to be a counter-revolution, and inevitably there's going to be a lot of work both on the ruins of the old regime, which are there and continue to be there, sometimes with a lot of vindictiveness, but also the mode of bringing in as many people as possible on the constitutional discussion, so that when a constitution is finally completed, that it does effectively represent the spirit of the revolution in the largest possible sense. So I think I'll stop here and let the larger discussion take its course. Thank you.
Right, thank you very much for being here with us, and we'll reconvene at 2:00.